This is a podcast from Deutsche Welle. For more information and a selection of other programs, click on to dwworld.de.
Deutsche Welle. World in progress. In this edition, with HIV/AIDS on the rise, Ugandan officials begin a new campaign to get people thinking about the topic again.
I can't marry her when I don't know her health status. That's why we decided to come for the HIV blood test, so everybody should know the status of one another.
Protesters say racial discrimination is continuing in New York City as police officers stop, question and frisk locals.
Because the NYPD is implementing
South Sudanese migrants return in droves to their homelands.
There's a certain desire, I think, here on the part of this government to have their citizens come back home now that they've got an independent country of their own.
And we'll find out what has the people of Pakistan singing again. Hello and welcome to World in Progress. I'm Jesse Wingard in Bonn. In New York City, where Occupy Wall Street began, protesters have been making their presence felt throughout the city for weeks, and they are making concrete demands. Civil rights protesters in the 1960s helped bring about the end of legalized racial discrimination in the United States. Members of Occupy Wall Street say discrimination continues in New York City through the routine stopping and questioning of people by police. The vast majority of those stopped are black or Latino. It's a controversial practice, and critics argue the police are engaging in racial profiling. Small groups of protesters have begun sit-ins at police stations throughout the city. And as Jonah Engel reports from Brooklyn, they are drawing on the civil rights movement for inspiration and tactics.
There is arguably no clearer illustration of the growing inequality that inspired the Occupy movement than the contrast between Wall Street and Brownsville, Brooklyn. Just a 30-minute subway ride from the financial center of the world, Brownsville has the highest concentration of public housing projects in the city. It is also highly segregated. 95% of its residents are black or Latino. But that isn't Brownsville's only distinction. Police stop its residents more than anywhere else in New York City to question them and often to search them for weapons or drugs. On a sunny afternoon, the chants of around 120 protesters rise above the din of rush hour traffic. They have come from Wall Street to the 73rd Police Precinct in Brownsville to protest the New York Police Department's stop and frisk policy. By law, a police officer can stop someone they think is committing or is about to commit a crime. If the officer suspects the person is armed, they can be frisked. Last year, the police department, or NYPD for short, made more than 600,000 stops, a record number. While blacks and Latinos make up 52% of the city's population, they accounted for 85% of those stopped. A small percentage of people stopped were charged with an offense, but all their names were entered into a database. At the entrance of the police station, a wall of officers squares off against the protesters. Police Captain Robert Gardner warns the protesters they face arrest. One of the protesters, Carl Dix, invokes the Freedom Riders, black and white civil rights activists who used civil disobedience to fight the system of racial discrimination known as Jim Crow in the American South.
If your intention
is to be
this generation
echoes of the civil rights movement are everywhere, from the protesters' tactics to their chants,
we say no to the new Jim Crow,
to the diversity of the protesters themselves. They are black, white, and Latino, old and young. Some have been occupying Wall Street for weeks. For others, It's their first protest. Sherrod Hayes is a 30-year-old African-American from Brownsville. He hasn't gone downtown to the Occupy Wall Street protests.
I like what they're doing, but me, I just can't be outside in a tent. So.
He's protesting because he doesn't feel the police protect him.
I'm out here because last summer I was assaulted by police on Rockaway, and they put my brother in the hospital.
Hayes says he and his friends experience daily harassment at the hands of the police.
It happens to all my friends every day. Every day we get stopped.
The growing number of stops and their racial disparities have been known for years. It is the leading complaint by citizens about the police. A federal class action lawsuit against the NYPD is before the courts, but there have been no concerted protests until now.
Yeah, we always talk about what needs to be done, but none of us ever took a step forward and really did nothing about it, you know?
One by one, protesters are arrested and loaded into a paddy wagon and driven away to be charged and booked. Standing watch is a middle-aged woman. She was arrested at the previous protest at a police precinct in Harlem 10 days earlier.
I'm doing jail support.
That means I'm being sure that we don't get anyone lost in the system. We have a whole team, including lawyers from Occupy Wall Street.
Deborah Sweet explains how this series of protests is connected to the Occupy movement.
Gets a lot of energy from Occupy Wall Street. It is absolutely out there to support the rights of the 99%, which almost never connect. Brownsville, Brooklyn would almost never connect with the young, white, middle-class banker protester, right?
The NYPD refused to be interviewed, but it argues that stops are a legitimate and important tool that takes guns off the streets and has helped drive down crime in New York. The police say that if they focus on certain neighborhoods like Brownsville, it's because that's where crime is concentrated. Outside the precinct, before the protesters arrived, a handful of leaders of Brownsville churches came to show their support for the police. Reverend Dan Craig is a pastor at Mount Zion Baptist Church.
We're meeting with key officers and key precincts. We're working together. We want the police to show more respect for the community, but we also want the community to show more respect for the police. But I will say things have gotten a lot better.
Reverend Craig grew up in the segregated South, where he witnessed the civil rights movement firsthand.
I'm originally from Selma, Alabama.
Selma is where Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. began a historic march in 1965 for voting rights. And while Reverend Craig has come out to show support for the police, he says he has sympathy for the Occupy movement.
They're saying a lot of good things, things that need to be brought to the forefront to be dealt with. Protesting, as long as it's done peaceful, it's all right.
For their part, protesters say they will keep up their campaign of civil disobedience at police precincts throughout the city until the NYPD changes its policy. Meanwhile, the number of stops in New York City is set to top 700,000, setting a new record for the fourth year in a row. Jonah Engel, Deutsche Welle Radio, Brooklyn, New York.
The world's newest nation, South Sudan, and its independence earlier this year has seen more than 350 southerners returning to their homeland. 3,000 of the latest arrivals came by barge, arriving in Juba on Monday after almost 2 weeks spent on the Nile. These are southerners who have spent, in some cases, their whole lives living in the north of Sudan. Now an independent country, the South Sudanese are returning to their homelands, bringing their families and possessions with them. Arrivals are often emotional as family members greet relatives they have not seen in decades. Jared Ferry is in South Sudan and witnessed this massive migration of southerners coming home via the Nile River.
I'm standing in Juba Port on the banks of the Nile River, and a barge that is jam-packed with returnees has just arrived. These people have been traveling 12 days down the river. Some of them have been away from their homeland for decades. Crowds have gathered here to welcome these people to their newly independent homeland of South Sudan.
She said that have been about 24 years outside this South Sudan. And now she's very happy. Even in this situation, but she's really proud. This is her country. She's my mother. That is a very, very joyous moment. I cannot even explain this thing.
Like many people here, Daniel Simon and Saloma Majok are family members who have spent years apart. There are still about 1 million Southerners living in Sudan. But more than 350,000 have come home to South Sudan, which declared independence on July 9th. These are the latest arrivals, coming in on two barges. There are eight more barges arriving in the next couple days. They'll be carrying everything from door frames to household items. The International Organization for Migration has assisted almost 20,000 of the returnees. Jan de Welde, the organization's chief of mission here, says people are excited to come home, but they're also being encouraged to do so by both governments.
If you will, on the push factor side, they don't know what is going to happen to them after April 9, 2012. Before that date, they have to get legal or get out, basically. And there are no provisions made yet for people getting legal in the north. And there's a certain desire, I think, here on the part of this government to have their citizens come back home now that they've got an independent country of their own.
We are here today receiving 3,200 returnees from Republic of Sudan. They are pleased and happy to be here. We are also glad to receive them.
Duer Tut Duer Makuak is chair of the Relief and Rehabilitation Commission. He's on hand to welcome this latest batch of returnees. But he admits his government has had difficulties providing land to some of the ones who have returned so far.
We know from a long time ago that they are going to be brought to the south. We were supposed to organize ourselves a long time ago. It was not done, but this time it is going to be done.
Ikhlas Manu Ahmed is one of those who has not received a parcel of land. In fact, she's been living in a makeshift shelter right next to the port since arriving 4 months ago.
Of course, Juba is her place where she wants to stay, but she has nowhere to go and nobody to take care of her. If only she can get a piece of land where she puts the family and her luggage, which is down here, she will be able to get something to do on her own, whether working, making tea or whatever. At least the family will sustain.
Ikhlas is sitting on a bed frame under a tree, and her three-year-old son is lying down listlessly next to her. He's sick with malaria.
She took the child to the hospital. The child has been prescribed drugs, but they are not there. She used to buy from the clinics, which she don't have money to buy.
She used to live in Malakia here in Juba town, and when she left this place, their house was the only house in the area. And now she got astonished by how the roads, the tarmac and everything in every place. She's very pleasant with her life here in Juba.
Fawzia Al-Hajj left Juba when she was just 7 years old. She came back a few weeks ago, and now she's waiting for her 8-year-old niece to disembark.
She prayed for God that prosperous will hit South Sudan, and she thinks that it's going to get better and better with time going on.
IOM says another 9,000 arrivals are expected over the next few weeks. For most of those returning, this is a joyous arrival in their new home, South Sudan, which is the world's newest country. But independence has brought its own challenges. Many of these people, like South Sudan itself, will have to struggle to pull themselves up from desperate poverty. In Juba, South Sudan, this is Jared Ferry for Deutsche Welle Radio.
While many return to South Sudan, thousands of immigrants are either living illegally or attempting to come to Europe to live, but are caught before they arrive. Destination Europe, a 15-week Deutsche Welle multimedia special, tells the story of these people trying to call Europe home.
When I watched television, I saw rich men, the way they live. I feel so bad of myself. I wish I'd be like them. Their children in better schools.
I took boat from Nodibo, came into Spain. My journey is 4 days. We are 71 peoples.
Actually, education is known as the social vaccine.
Deutsche Welle has met with those on a journey into the unknown. They tell their stories about Destination Europe.
Project Director Jan-Philipp Scholz joins me in the studio to tell us about the series of The Journey into the Unknown. Jan, what is the Destination Europe special?
With Destination Europe, we want to show the perspective of African migrants themselves. In the last months, we've heard very many reports about the different challenges that migration issues pose on politics and on society in Europe. But of course, most of the challenges concern the migrating people themselves. So we want to find out what drives them to seek a new life far away from home, and what do they experience while they travel, and how do they live in the land of their dreams. So this is the questions we want to ask with Destination Europe.
And what can people expect from the multimedia special?
We want to paint a realistic picture of both migration and the lives of migrants in Europe. And we use all different media formats to do so. So we have video profiles of migrants, we have a radio drama about migration, and we have a lot of background information on related issues.
And our listeners that would like to look at the Destination Europe webpage, where can they find that?
From Thursday, you will find the online special on our website at dw-world.de/Destination Europe. And of course, you can also listen to the radio drama on our radio program Africa Link. And last but not least, you can visit us on Facebook to tell us your own migration story and to discuss the issue with us.
Jan, thank you for joining me. That address again, dw-world.de/Destination Europe. In the 1980s, Uganda was one of the first African countries that admitted some of its people were affected by HIV/AIDS. The policy of openly dealing with the pandemic, combined with good AIDS education campaigns, has helped reduce AIDS infection rates in the East African country. But recently, infection rates have been rising again. That's why the Ugandan government has started a new campaign to counter the dangerous attitude of taking the virus less seriously. Juliet Nalwuga from the Uganda radio station Alpha FM and Deutsche Welle's Frieda Tauber compiled this report, which is presented by Uncle Asper.
Today it's me, tomorrow someone else.
Today it's me, tomorrow someone else. That's what Ugandan musician Phili Lutaya sang 25 years ago. He was the first VIP in his country to admit he was HIV positive. New campaigns are now encouraging people to be faithful to their partners. In Uganda, being faithful is promoted as the ultimate method of preventing HIV/AIDS. The government's new campaign, Go Together, Know Together, encourages young people to go to a hospital together to be tested for HIV. Just like Justin Arungu and his fiancée Ellen at the Kiswa Health Center in Kampala.
I can't marry her when I don't know her health status. That's why we decided to come for the HIV blood test, so everybody should know the status of one another.
Justin and Ellen have been a couple for 7 months. Now they've decided to have their HIV tests done together. Their blood pressure is measured, they're weighed, then a nurse draws a vial of blood for the test. 30 minutes later, they will get the results.
If it has happened, one of us is negative and one of us is positive, we shall go for the counselors, then they're the one to give us the guidelines. Then we see the next procedures for our life. If you decide to continue, then we shall continue for that kind of marriage. But even that marriage, it is not mean you not produce. Still, all of you will produce. That is not the case. Because I've got people, the one is HIV negative and one is HIV positive, but they are still producing their children.
It's very important for the medical staff to counsel their patients with empathy and compassion. That's why there are not only medical doctors and nurses working here, but also psychologists like Julius Alokim. He knows that taking an HIV test together can mean a lot more to the patients than just being pricked with a needle.
It is not easy for them to come as a couple. You might find that one will first come and do what? And test. After finding that he's HIV negative, is when we'll go and give the other hand or the opponent also, let's go and do it. So when another one finds that he's already HIV positive, he'll not go and tell the other one, let's go and do it. And test. He has to keep quiet.
Whoever decides to take the test also proves they trust their partner. That makes it even harder for couples who get two different results for their tests. That one partner is negative, the other HIV positive, happens up to 10 times a week here, says Julius Alokim.
Their reaction posed for us here in council, the way we first handle them, we counsel them as a couple, two people. Then we request, we need to talk to one by one. Because when as a couple like this, when you ask them, do you have someone outside? He will not tell you automatically because the husband is there or the madam is there. But when you separate them, it's when you find that one is afraid to tell you that even before my wife, I have someone where outside, but I've not told my woman.
Justin and Ellen are relieved as they get their results. Both are HIV negative. From now on, they want to have the tests done regularly. They are certain that faithfulness is the best means for them to avoid an HIV infection.
We feel okay because we are together. We are not separate. Why do we feel okay? Because one another is confidence of the health status she has. Because if you are not confident, that's when you will not feel okay.
Today it's me, tomorrow someone else. Singer Philly Lutaya died of AIDS in 1989. Those who listen to his song today don't only think of him, but also of the millions of others who have died of the virus over the past 3 decades. To curb the rate of HIV infection, Uganda's government must now get people thinking about HIV again. If they succeed, Uganda could once again become a role model for fighting HIV. Anke Rasper, Deutsche Welle Radio.
For 4 years, music was banned in the Bajoa province in tribal Pakistan near the Afghan border. Music has been an integral part of the local culture for generations. However, when Taliban militants took control of the area in 2006 and 2007, they declared music in all forms un-Islamic and it was strictly banned. A Pakistani military operation ousted the rebels from the area in March this year. Now musicians are free to perform in public again, and the local people are happy, as Mudassir Shah discovered in Bajoa.
Young tribal people warmly greet people who arrive at a local elder's large guest house, locally known as Hujra. They are here for a wedding celebration. In the tribal areas, a hujra is a gathering place for men only. It consists of multiple rooms, a yard, veranda, and in most cases a mosque, which is surrounded by walls. While the women celebrate inside homes, the men spend the day with formal celebrations and feasting. And in the night, it's time for music. 55-year-old Abdul Ghani welcomes guests in his hujra. He has invited some 500 people from the nearby villages, relatives and friends to celebrate his younger brother's wedding. Abdul Ghani is a local elder or malak.
I'm very happy to arrange and organize the musical performance for the marriage of my brother. Music is part of our culture and we can't leave our culture. I think other people should also organize such music programs to celebrate a happy occasion. Music is part of our culture and we will follow our culture even if we are killed for doing it.
Under the open sky, a group of musicians begin to play music. Rabab is an integral musical instrument of Pashto music. The rabab consists of a small rounded body. The front is covered by a sheepskin. The long, thick neck has 2 or 3 strings. The instrument is held upright, resting on the lap, like a mother breastfeeds a child. The audience is excited. It's been 4 years since Shabir Khan has attended a music program like this one, so the 20-year-old is very enthusiastic.
I'm very happy to be here to listen to the music. People enjoy music, and all people are happy that music performances are back in our area. Now there's peace also in our area. Our people have passed through miseries and difficult times and military operations for a long time. I welcome and I get very happy during such music programs because it's a sign that peace has returned.
On the dance floor, some of the boys pull out guns and start firing real bullets into the night sky. This is a traditional Pashtun way to express happiness. One of the guests at the wedding is Noor Muhammad Khan. He runs a community program for the young tribal people. He says The Taliban's ban on music was devastating.
The Taliban broke all musical instruments they found in every house. They strictly forbid people to perform music because they say music is against Islamic law. Due to the Taliban, attitude towards music, the culture, and their values have been completely changed in tribal areas.
The Taliban also banned girls from going to school and bombed girls' school. They stopped parents from vaccinating their children against polio and closed all barber shops, as men were told not to shave. People still fear that Taliban militants might return to the region and that music events too would then come under attack again. But poets and singers try to encourage people to overcome their fear. At the wedding, one of the musicians sings a famous ghazal. While traditionally, ghazals are based on classical poetry, musicians also express modern thoughts and ideas. In the audience at the wedding clearly appreciates this.
Everyone has rights to their own motherland. I reject other people taking control of this land. My motherland wants me to free it from foreign rule.
Village elder Gulzada stands out the front of the wedding compound, checking everyone, looking them from head to toe. It is considered as bad to physically check guests who come to the wedding. Despite the ongoing threats, he is optimistic that music can play a role in bringing about peace.
I believe that if people gather for music events, they develop brotherhood and friendly relations among each other. Besides, such events also increase the courage among people. The peace which we have lost in our areas can easily be restored through music. We all must follow our old traditional ways and culture so that we can help restore happiness and peace in the area.
32-year-old journalist and singer Shanawaz performs one of these songs called Sandara. It calls for unity among the Pashtuns of Pakistan and Afghanistan. Most of the Pashtun like Sandara because it covers diverse range of topics from love to patriotism and also daily routine activities. He has recently received death threats from hardline militants for his music performances as well as for his journalistic work.
Journalists say the reality and nobody who is wrong listen reality because they want their own. I sing those songs which is for the unity of our community and I want to educate my Pakhtun people. I want to tell them how they can be able to stand side by side with the other developed world. But militants do not want this.
Outside the gates, a group of 8-year-old girls stand, peep through the main gate, enjoying from a distance the music and dancing taking place inside. Musical events for women are not yet being held in this region. Shanawaz finishes his performance with a song known as Loba with the lyrics, "I wish young tribal people will always be able to gather to celebrate happiness." Loba means play. Two male singers play the parts of a lover and his beloved, replying to each other in the song. Shanawaz sings himself while the wedding guests start dancing the traditional Atana dance. The long hair of the dancers flies as they whirled around in fast circles, enjoying life and the return of live musical performances to their lives. For Deutsche Welle Radio, this is Mudassar Shah in Bajawad, Pakistan.
If you would like to listen to this show again, go to our webpage at dw-world.de/development. From Thursday, be sure to check out Destination Europe at dw-world.de/Destination Europe. I'm Jesse Wingard saying thanks for listening and goodbye.
You've been listening to a podcast from Deutsche Welle. We hope you enjoyed the program. You'll find more information and podcasts at dwworld.de.